Support for the World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Bringing the war back home to an election today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. North Carolina is home to more than 500,000 veterans. They're a big voting bloc in a state where the presidential race is too close to call. So what are they going to do?
I'm going to vote for Donald Trump. I would have to say, in a more honest answer, that I'm voting for him because I don't want Hillary Clinton to be president.
I do not think that Donald Trump possesses the requisite skills to be commander-in-chief at this point. Think about who you personally would want to be your platoon sergeant, your commanding officer.
Plus, the New York bombing suspect had visited Afghanistan and Pakistan, but don't jump to the conclusion that he was radicalized there.
The guy went home. He went home to visit family. Since when is it sinister?
Those stories today here on The World. Good to have you with us. We begin today by talking about refugees. President Obama also did that today during his final speech to the UN General Assembly in New York.
Helping people who've been pushed to the margins of our world is not mere charity. It is a matter of collective security. And the purpose of this institution is not merely to avoid conflict, it is to galvanize the collective action that makes life better on this planet.
Nations have to do more, he said. Greece, given its economy, is doing a lot, and on the Greek island of Lesbos, the plight of refugees has been evident for a while. Thousands of refugees are stuck there right now, and they're desperate to reach other destinations in Europe. Last night, a huge fire swept through one camp on the island, the Moria camp. The flames destroyed tents and forced people to flee again. Reporter Jean Carsonson is on Lesbos. I asked her to describe what led to that fire.
There were some protests in the morning over the slow rate of processing the asylum claims. People at Moria have been there for months and months, ever since March 20th, when the EU-Turkey deal came into effect. So they were protesting, and months of frustration, it just built up over the day, and protests grew into generalized unrest and fighting among different nationalities. People started burning the olive groves, burning garbage bins, and this eventually spread even further until about 800 people lost their housing. They burned down tents and they burned down some of the trailers inside this camp. About 60% of Moria was damaged or destroyed.
Were there any fatalities?
There were no fatalities and there were no serious injuries, but there were lots of bruises and a lot of mental anguish and desperation. 4,000 people have been crammed into a facility that is really only meant for 2,000. Conditions are terrible. They've been denounced month after month by human rights organizations, and things never seem to improve. And they had to then evacuate, move out into the roads with no idea where they would be headed.
You were at this camp as this fire and these fights were going on, right? I mean, it sounds pretty chaotic.
It was very chaotic. It was hard to even get to the camp because there were thousands of people walking along the roads. We saw people turned back by locals and police, and there were even some Golden Dawn members who had infiltrated and were part of the group of people forcing these refugees to stay near the camp.
And what is Golden Dawn?
Golden Dawn is a fascist group in Greece. Here on Lesbos, Golden Dawn has been making an appearance, and this has been denounced by the local government.
So you spoke with some of the refugees at the Moria camp during the incident. What did you hear? What did they tell you?
I spoke to a man on the road who was among the thousands of people evacuating, and he told me that the unrest was actually a disaster for the refugees themselves, but that it was fueled by months of frustration over these delays in processing their asylum claims.
Ma'am, we are not coming here to burn our bed. We are sleeping here. We are living here. Okay? For how many months? You got my point? Nobody won't burn his home. This is our home now, okay? But we are trying to find the solution between everybody. He or me, any color here, we have the same situation. We are refugee. We are coming here for this country or for Europe asking for mercy.
So, Gene, his comments raise a bunch of questions. First of all, has calm actually been restored in the camp today? And where will these migrants go now?
I went there this morning and it was quiet, but I spoke to many people who had spent the night outside in the rough with absolutely no shelter. And they did not have breakfast or water by 10 a.m. when I was there. What I understand is that the Greek government is going to be bringing in passenger ferries, one or two ferries, to hopefully temporarily house these people. I don't know what they'll be doing tonight.
Also, that man's point that no one wants their home to burn down. How is this ordeal affecting them after all they've been through?
I saw so much trauma last night and this morning. It was really awful. Many of these people are fleeing war. They were clustered along the roads, holding babies, holding their few belongings. I spoke with a 21-year-old man from Kabul who was out on the streets, and he told me his family had just lost everything.
Where will you sleep tonight? Do you have a place?
No. We don't have sleep. Everything burned, my documents, my everything, to I brought from Afghanistan. Everything burns, not only me, from all of people, from all of refugees. We all escape from war. We all escape from war.
Wow. So, Gene, if this horrible event, these fights and this fire was kind of a result of the tense situation in the camp, should we be expecting more of this in other refugee camps?
Well, you know, all around the islands in Chios, Samos, Lesvos, this kind of unrest has been increasing. A couple weeks ago on Chios, there were big protests against the refugees. You're seeing that the islands where people are trapped, these are small populations, they themselves are under economic pressure, and it's kind of a toxic mix. So I do expect we will be seeing more challenging situations like this really in the days and weeks ahead.
Reporter Gene Carstensen on the Greek island of Lesbos. Thank you very much, Gene.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Let's focus now on one refugee story. Mohammed Badran was just 19 when he was forced to flee his home in Syria. He had received threats because of humanitarian work he was doing at the time. He eventually was given asylum by the Netherlands and settled there. That's when he decided to focus on giving back. Badran and some Syrian friends created a group of volunteers, and they provide community services, mostly to Dutch residents.
We are missing positive images and the positive voice from refugees. People, they want to see us like victims. We experience some difficult situation, but that will not make us for whole our life victims. So I really wanted to show the people how we are taking action, how we are trying to help to be a solution to solve this crisis.
Yeah, meantime, you're facing some pretty strident attitudes. You may have seen that Donald Trump's eldest son caused a stir online yesterday, posting a photo on Twitter of a bowl of candy called Skittles. And underneath it, he wrote, "If I had a bowl of Skittles and I told you just three would kill you, would you take a handful? That's our Syrian refugee problem." What do you make of that?
Being a refugee, you know, it's really an experience itself. It's not a label. This experience, like, it was really tough and it was really, you know, difficult as well. It taught me that right now how to become strong, you know what I mean? Mm.
And you and your friends launched a program to undertake community service projects. What kind of things do you do?
We started this idea because we believe in voluntary work. A lot of people, they talk about how refugees are coming to steal their jobs. So we have right now the database of the 600 volunteers. And then we try to search for a Dutch organization. And then we try to match them with refugees. What we do is go and help elderly people with a garden, cleaning garden.
The elderly Dutch, though, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And they really enjoy it. It's like our team is right now mixed. It's like Dutch and Syrians. And then they go together. They have a chat. You are bringing them together for a good cause.
Do you have one specific example where that happened?
We have like right now a project called Green Team, the one for cleaning the garden for elderly people. Send a project to other Dutch organizations. They have their team. So we send our volunteers to them and then they try to have a coffee and then go together. And then like they work together and afterwards they sit together and start sharing the experience of this work.
Yeah. Do you ever scratch your head and wonder why are the rich countries taking in comparatively few refugees to the poor countries?
Let's, you know, talk about the facts. They are not taking. We are coming, you know. there is no safe routes for refugees. We want to provide safe routes. That's a right as well. You know, you should have the right of escaping the wars.
Mohamed Badran, co-founder of Syrian Volunteers in the Netherlands. You may have seen him yesterday speaking at the UN General Assembly about refugees. Mohamed, great to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Marco. Cheers.
Our presidential election here in the U.S. is scheduled for November 8th, and we can pretty much count on it staying that way. Not the case for voters in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Yesterday, authorities there postponed that country's presidential election. And as we've seen in several other African nations in recent years, that is a spark that can set off chaos and violence. And it did in Congo's capital, Kinshasa. Dozens of people have died. Jeffrey Gettleman is East Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He arrived in Kinshasa yesterday.
The minute I landed, I could tell something was wrong. No cars were allowed to leave the airport. The streets outside were deserted. You could see huge columns of black smoke in the distance. Lots of army trucks racing back and forth on these deserted boulevards. And what happened was these riots had exploded in this slum area near the airport, and they paralyzed the city. Nobody could travel through there. Cars were getting stoned. Some cars were getting burned. Police officers were attacked. Banks were looted, shops were burned. I mean, it was a real burst of chaos. And the root of it is this anger about what's happening with the election or the lack of the election. Mm. But it's being exploited by the fact that there's just thousands of idle youth on the streets of Kinshasa, very poor people with a lot of pent-up anger. And this was just the spark.
So what's been going on, Jeffrey? Why did officials delay the elections?
This goes back several years. Congo is one of the biggest countries in sub-Saharan Africa, one of the poorest, and one of the most reliably chaotic. They were supposed to have an election at the end of this year, and they've done zero preparation for it. It looks like the president of Congo, Joseph Kabila, is trying to delay having an election with the possibility that he might not leave office. And the Congo Constitution says that the president should leave office by the end of the year because he has served two elected terms. So what a lot of people here are worried about is that this delay in the election, which has been justified on technical reasons that there needs to be improvements done to the voter lists, the government has to get organized and set up the whole election process, which they haven't done. People are worried that that's just an excuse.
Right. And now there's violence in Kinshasa. Is that still active?
Yeah, it is. There seems to be a dirty war that's shaping up on the streets of the city, with supporters and opponents of the president killing each other. There's no real evidence of who's doing this, but in the morning, bodies are found on the street. Houses are destroyed. People are worried that this is going to spread and that the government is losing control over its own forces.
So aside from keeping your eyes on the streets of Kinshasa, Jeffrey, what are you going to be looking out for to see which way this conflict is going next?
It's really hard to read. I've been talking to diplomats because Western governments are trying to pressure Congo into coming up with some type of compromise. I've been talking to opposition leaders. I've been talking to government people who are, you know, relatively close to Kabila. I think it's really uncertain what's going to happen. And the reason why we should care is Congo is one of the biggest countries in Africa. And the last time that it sank into a political crisis in the mid-90s, millions of people died. Several other African countries jumped into the conflict. And it created an instability across a wide part of Africa that then cost billions of dollars and lots of attention to try to calm it down. So we're right now at the beginning phases of another crisis, and that's why there's a lot of concern about what's going to happen in the next coming weeks.
Jeff Gettleman of the New York Times in Kinshasa, good to speak with you again. Thank you.
No problem. Glad to help.
You are with The World. According to the polls, the race is tightening. That means every vote will count, especially in those all-important swing states. And the votes from Americans abroad might also make a difference, which is why political activists are looking to win over votes in Israel. William Booth is the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. So you've been talking to voters in Israel, William. Before we get to their preferences, how many potential votes are we talking about?
If you ask the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv or the consulate in Jerusalem how many American citizens live in Israel at any one time, they estimate between 200 to 400,000. It's probably on the lower end. So there might be a couple of hundred thousand U.S. citizens here who would be eligible to vote. So that's not trivial.
Is there any chance those votes could have an impact in any of the battleground states?
Yes, there is. According to folks here, there is. Because if we remember in 2000, it went down to 500 or 600 votes in Florida, particularly in Palm Beach County, which was divided by the infamous butterfly ballot. They think that in a super tight swing state, Pennsylvania, maybe Florida, a little bit in Ohio, a large number of Jewish U.S. citizens living in Israel could help one side or the other. I mean, in a real squeezer of an election.
So President Obama is not very popular with Israelis, but he strongly endorsed Hillary Clinton, and both Bill and Hillary have a long pro-Israel track record. What does that all mean for this race?
Well, this is a particularly strange race because there are supporters of Donald Trump that are known to be anti-Semitic and the alt-right, and you would think that like Jewish voters would not line up behind Donald Trump. But President Obama, for one reason or another, is very unpopular in Israel. People say it's kind of a mirror image to the vote, the Jewish vote in the United States. If it's 70% Democrat versus 30% Republican in the United States among Jewish voters, people would say it's the opposite here. So Donald Trump could pick up some votes here.
Have you spoken with some of those Trump supporters in Israel about things that Trump himself has said, say, about Syrian refugees? Because a lot of critics see a parallel with the desperation of Jewish refugees during World War II, whose lives were determined by quotas and prejudice here in the U.S. and in other countries. They see a problem there.
Yeah, I think they probably would. I mean, among U.S. citizens who are also Israelis here that I've spoken with, you have some who came to Israel in the 60s, 70s, who were and probably still are on the left side of the political spectrum, who find the idea of a Donald Trump presidency like completely mystifying or abhorrent, right? And you find newer arrivals who are looking for sort of a tough anti-terrorist, maybe even anti-Arab position, the things that Donald Trump has said about, well, let's carpet bomb them or let's waterboard them or let's, you know, round them all up. I mean, some of that is, you know, honey in some people's ear here.
Overall, William, do Israelis pay pretty close attention to American politics? Because one rabbi you met spends his retirement watching Fox News.
Yes. The Israelis across the board are most interested in Israel and themselves. But then if they had to pick a second, they're fascinated by like the United States and U.S. politics. I mean, the longest running soap opera in Israel of the last few years is Obama and Bibi Netanyahu, right? So the Israelis are sort of obsessed with the U.S. They're watching the election, I think, very closely. I mean, even in Israeli electoral politics, this is kind of a strange one, even for them here.
Well, it's strange for a lot of people. The Washington Post, William Booth in Jerusalem. Thank you.
Anytime. Happy to do it.
Okay. Speaking of soap operas, our partners at the BBC have launched a new radio program for Syrians, all Syrians, whether they're still in the war-torn country or outside as refugees. It is not a news program. It's a drama called Hayal Matar and is broadcast via shortwave radio. Here's how my BBC colleague Lena Sinjab describes it.
It sets the scene inside an imaginary avenue inside Syria, and it talks about people's lives right now. And it's dedicated to Syrian refugees, Syrian migrants, wherever they go, to tell their stories and reflect on their lives.
And when you say refugees, you mean not just refugees from Syria outside Syria, but also internally displaced people.
Yes, exactly. So basically the idea and the storyline is to talk about Syrians wherever they are. So the scene, as you can hear it, is actually taking place somewhere inside Syria. But all the characters are talking about problems all over the world now, wherever the Syrians have gone or the war has pushed them. So you can find characters inside where they have relatives in Lebanon, where they have friends in Germany, or they're trying to cross the border to Turkey. So it's basically really reflecting the reality. It's not taking any side of the conflict in Syria. It's just talking about the human side of Syrians.
And the title, Hayal Matar, what does that mean?
It means the airport avenue, and it's also reflective of the transition phase that Syrians are living in. So almost every day there are Syrians traveling, there are Syrians packing, there are Syrians thinking of travel. It's everyone feels they are in a transit, even if they are reached to Europe or they are in Lebanon or they are in Turkey. No one feels stable. That people are seeking safety, but they're not stable. So it's the airport avenue, as if people are leaving and people are coming back.
Gotcha. So this is a soap opera that's obviously much more than just entertainment. Can you give us an example of a plot line?
So, for example, the first three episodes were talking about one character who is a guard in at a checkpoint in a government-controlled area where he's young, he's holding arms and he's underage, and he's abusing the system. So he threatens one restaurant owner because she told him, "You're not allowed to bring weapons into the restaurant." So we hear him trying to threaten her with the weapons, and that reflects how arming the conflict has created chaos, has created no rule of law, and anyone can violate the rules of law wherever they are because they simply hold up arm. So it really reflects on what Syrians are living in their daily life, whether they are inside Syria or elsewhere.
So there's also this live discussion, as I said, that happens right after Hayal Matar that you host. What kinds of conversations has the soap opera opened up?
So we pick up a subject every week from the drama and raise it in the discussion program. We have episodes coming talking about marriage and how the war affected relationship in people's life, you know, about corruption in the security system, all sorts of ideas that basically come out from the drama but are very relevant and very lively.
What has surprised you most about the discussion so far, Lena?
Well, I think as a Syrian reporter who covered the war in Syria, there was always the sad story that you cover on a daily basis, the bombardment of shelling, of people being killed, people being displaced. But I've always felt as a Syrian as well that there are lots of other stories to tell, that there are moments of laughter and joke that I would love to hear and I would love the world to listen to. And I think that's what the Syrian Cafe or Al Maqha Souri, the discussion program, is providing, and hopefully it will be successful at it.
My BBC colleague Lena Sinjab in Beirut, thank you very much for telling us about Hayal Matar.
Thank you very much.
This is The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. There's a new way to roll through the streets of Paris.
Okay, just the cobblestones.
But once you're past the cobblestones,
very smooth. Almost at the Champs-Élysées here. I'm not sure I'm going to do that yet.
The City of Lights on an electric scooter. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Federal investigators are still trying to get the whole story on Ahmad Khan Rahami. He's the man arrested yesterday in connection with the bombings in New York and New Jersey over the weekend. Rahami is a naturalized U.S. citizen who was born in Afghanistan but grew up in New Jersey. Authorities are now focusing on Rahami's travels in recent years, in particular, trips to Pakistan and Afghanistan. Journalist Masha Gessen is critical of much of the news coverage of the Rahami case so far. She questions why some reporters are concluding that Rahami was radicalized during his travels.
We don't know anything. As far as I know, we don't know anything. But also, I mean, the guy went home. He went home to visit family. Since when is it sinister? And it's only just a very short step from that to the kind of rhetoric that Donald Trump has been trafficking in since the New York bombings, which is, you know, it's all about the lax immigration policies. The suggestion that there is something sinister about an immigrant going home to visit family is so evil. It's so frightening to me.
You kind of delved into this with the Tsarnaev brothers in your book, The Brothers, and you describe how Tamerlan, the older brother, went back to Dagestan and received wisdom in the media, is that he was radicalized there. So what is wrong with the radicalization narrative? Because even now, Rahami's father is suggesting that he thought he was a terrorist at one point.
What's wrong with the radicalization narrative is that it's very unhelpful in fighting terrorism.
Why?
Because it's basically wrong. It makes us imagine that there is some sort of force out there that recruits young men, that takes them through the paces. And the FBI will tell you that there's the pre-radicalization stage and then the radicalization stage. And then finally, you have a fully fledged terrorist as the outcome. Everything we know about how terrorists come to be proves that narrative wrong. A lot of the time, radical beliefs that are part of radicalization are an afterthought. Sort of the plan is there first, and then radical beliefs are there second. But even more important, radical beliefs are not a predictor of terrorist behavior. No kind of belief is a predictor of violent behavior, period.
You know, Masha, we've had parents on the program who thought they knew their kids. They thought their kids were loving, kind, sweet children, and then suddenly they don't know them, and that kid is off to fight for ISIS in Syria. What is wrong of thinking that there is kind of a before and after moment, like a switch that somehow is turned on?
Well, I think we need to separate the ISIS recruitment efforts, which are real and do, you know, this actually happens to people, from terrorism prevention efforts. Because, again, the terrorist attacks in this country, the Boston Marathon bombing, the Orlando shooting this year, these dumpster bombings in New York and New Jersey, these are lone wolves. These are men whose connection to international terrorism is very much in their heads. It's imagined. And I think that peddling this narrative of this connection only helps their imaginations run wild. It's sort of a shortcut to belonging to something that's much bigger than you are, that maybe doesn't have any need for you, just like you feel the rest of the world doesn't have any need for you. But at least you can claim allegiance to it.
What if, though, this is the time when that link is not imagined?
It is always possible. But the problem with coverage of the New York story is that there's no evidence for that. In another story, journalists wrote about their having run a family business as though it was suspicious that a family business didn't have non-family employees. Suddenly, everything that is normal becomes pathologized and starts sounding sinister. The fact that they had a family business, that it was somewhere, it was called a secretive shack. It's like they were you know, cooking up dynamite chicken in their shack.
So in forming some kind of policy to fight lone wolves and ISIS recruits, do you think Washington, do lawmakers understand the differences and the nuances?
They don't seem to understand the differences and the nuances. I've been really disturbed by the fact that both presidential candidates have started immediately talking about these bombings as a national security issue. And, you know, there's no evidence that this is a national security issue. This is obviously a safety issue. People were injured. But this guy, as terrorists go, he's pretty much a loser. He didn't manage to do much, and he didn't even manage to get away. So framing it as a national security issue rather than the issue of security for residents of New York City and New Jersey, I think is misleading, and it's panic peddling.
Masha Gessen, always good to speak with you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for calling.
We just passed the 15th anniversary of 9/11, and thinking back to 2001, there was a lot of fear after the attacks on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. And there was also a spike in hate crimes against Muslims in the U.S., also against people who were just thought to be Muslims. Naomi Gingold of station KJZZ in Phoenix has the story of one of the first victims of those crimes and how his family is getting on.
The day after September 11th, 2001, Rana Singh Sodhi and his brother Balbir were out running some errands. But Rana says,
people yell to us, using F-word and go back to your country.
Thing is, they were in their country. They'd immigrated to the U.S. more than a decade before. The Sodhis belong to the Sikh faith. The men don't cut their hair. They wear it in turbans and have beards. And after 9/11, all their Sikh friends were having a hard time. Rana says they thought,
we need to do something, otherwise somebody get hurt.
So they decided to hold a press conference the following Sunday to tell people, hey, we're Sikhs. We believe in peace. We're not terrorists. The day before the press conference, Balbir went shopping for an American flag and couldn't find one. On his way out of Costco that day, he stopped by a table for victims of 9/11 and gave them all the cash in his wallet, about $75. About 30 minutes later, he was dead. A man who said he wanted to kill Muslims had driven up to Balbir's gas station and shot him. The Sodhis came to the U.S. to escape the violent persecution of Sikhs in India in the 1980s. like many others, they saw the U.S. as a safe haven.
Have a turban, enjoy your religion, enjoy your life, fulfill your dream. I didn't know that, you know, in America we have so much hate exists until 9/11 happened.
But Sodhi says after his brother's shooting, there was also an outpouring of love from the community. 3,000 people showed up at the city's memorial service. People spread flowers in the gas station parking lot.
That's really opened my heart.
Today, Rana speaks at local schools and events all over the country. He's been featured in documentaries, been invited to the White House. And when he sees people staring at him now, he goes out of his way to say hi and tell them his story.
I thought this is my responsibility. I think this is every citizen of this country's responsibility to educate their children, educate the community, educate your neighbors.
Especially when hate crimes against Muslims or those perceived to be Muslims are still more than double what they were before 9/11. Rana has had someone walk into his gas station and tell him, "You leave or you will die." Another Sodhi brother was killed in suspicious circumstances. Still, he's amazingly positive. One time when he was out shopping, he says, a woman with two kids stopped him and said,
"Are you the same person? I saw you on a PBS channel in the documentary." Then I say, "Yes." And then she says, "Thank you for educating my children." That's, you know, I feel so good.
Sodhi has a large extended family in Phoenix and has raised three kids here.
I cut my hair literally a year ago.
Supreet Singh Sodhi is Rana's 21-year-old son. And when I meet him, I'm really surprised that he does not have a turban.
I've lived my whole life with having the hair and having the turban and all that. And, like, I went through high school, junior high and all that with that. Yeah, of course there was conflicts and there was people where they would say stuff.
But that's not why he cut it. He says he did it because he wanted to feel what it'd be like to cut his hair for the first time ever. Today, almost none of the younger men in his family wear turbans. I ask him if taking off his turban has made life easier. He says, yeah, but...
I feel like just being brown in general is rough living, you know? But at the same time, we've gone through it, you know, for so long that it's just normal now, you know? Even after my haircut, you know, I still get dirty looks from people. I mean, there's no other reason besides my skin color now. Like, I don't wear something on my head.
Last Thursday night, on the 15th anniversary of Balbir's death, around 130 people gathered in the parking lot of his gas station for a memorial service. One woman who'd lost her stepfather on 9/11 even flew in from New York. At the end of the service, Rana Singh Sodhi spoke.
Before the death of my brother, half hour before, he called me.
He asked him to bring an American flag.
And that's his last wish. He wanted to put a flag on his gas station. I'd like to invite Mesa PD.
Everyone watched as two police officers raised the American flag next to the spot where Balbir was murdered. Today, Balbir Singh Sodhi's turban and diary are in the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. For the world, Naomi Gingold, Phoenix.
Presidential candidates Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have both been spending a lot of time in North Carolina lately. Perhaps no state has them closer in the polls or harder to call. North Carolina is a mix of rural and urban, black and white. It's also a state with a huge military presence. Fort Bragg is the largest military base in the world, and more than 700,000 veterans call the state home. Their votes will be crucial come November, but hard to predict. The World's Jason Margolis spoke with a few veterans about what's motivating them as voters this year.
David McLennan has been to a lot of political rallies in North Carolina. He's a political scientist at Meredith College in Raleigh. He studies the crowds and has noticed something unusual at Trump rallies.
You know, it's loud, raucous crowds, but you don't see people who appear to be current or former military.
McLennan says when George W. Bush, even Mitt Romney, campaigned in North Carolina, military folks came out in force. Historically, the military vote has gone solidly Republican, but many historical patterns don't hold true this go-round.
In part because the two candidates aren't typical candidates for president.
Donald Trump has expressed more isolationist views than recent Republicans. Hillary Clinton is more hawkish than her party predecessors. The other thing that's unusual this year, how deeply unpopular both candidates are. I met Trump supporter and Army veteran 34-year-old Andrew Malone at a restaurant in Cary, North Carolina. His answers were typical of what I heard from vets supporting Trump.
I would have to say, in a more honest answer, that I'm voting for him because I don't want Hillary Clinton to be president.
Why is that?
Well, I don't even know where to start with that question. Beyond the lying, you know, you constantly hear people say all politicians lie, but she's trying to set a record.
Malone served in Iraq 10 years ago. I asked which national security matters were most important to him, ISIS or tensions with Russia or China, to name a few.
Well, it's just the simple fact that you have to ask me the question with that many options is what's at the top of my list. I mean, pick one.
Malone says he's absolutely been offended by a lot of Trump's military-related comments. For instance, Trump questioning John McCain's service because he was captured in Vietnam. But Malone calls those, quote, stupid remarks, ones that he can get past. He puts the blame for many of the world's problems at Hillary Clinton's feet.
I look at her job as Secretary of State. I think she did a terrible job as Secretary of State. And I don't think she's going to make a good president.
But other veterans see Clinton's track record as a selling point.
She's been in the Washington area for a long time, and her experience as Secretary of State is without a doubt very important.
I met 27-year-old former Marine Dean Castaldo, also in a restaurant, this one in Greensboro. I asked him if he'd describe himself as pro-Clinton or anti-Trump.
So this is a loaded question, right? I do not think that Donald Trump possesses the requisite skills to be Commander-in-Chief at this point.
Get more specific there. Like, what scares you about Donald Trump?
So I guess this is what I would say, right? If I had a junior Marine and we were discussing these issues, I would say I'm not going to tell you to vote for either one. But what I am going to say is think about who you personally would want to be your platoon sergeant. Who would you want to be your commanding officer? And do you want somebody that has experience in dealing with the multitude of issues that the president will have to deal with? Do you want somebody that at least at the end of the day gives you that feeling they're going to take care of you?
Castaldo thinks Trump is looking out for his own self-interest and doesn't trust the man's temperament. According to recent polls, just half of military and veteran voters have confidence in Trump's ability to be commander-in-chief. Yet many of those same voters say they'll still vote for Trump. This helps explain why I couldn't get any enthusiastically pro-Trump veterans to speak with me. Dean Castaldo, the Hillary voter, offered to bring some pro-Trump military friends to lunch, but they all backed out.
For many of those Trump supporters, they're picking him because of things that their gut is telling them feels right. The things he says, you know, it reassures them that, you know, America's going to be great again and that, you know, we'll have increased military spending and this and that. But I think when some of those people do a little bit of soul searching and they really start thinking through what he has said, they realize there's not a whole lot there. And so that uncertainty and that lack of confidence in him, I think that plays a very important role in as to why they're not going to talk with the media.
I also asked Andrew Malone to bring an avid Trump supporter. Initially, he said no problem. But in the end, he also failed.
I think that it's important to realize there is a stigma to verbally, publicly expressing support for Donald Trump. I know a lot of people that privately will tell me that they absolutely support Donald Trump, but if I were to bring that up around other people, they would shy away from that because they feel like they're going to be attacked.
Add it all up, it makes this already unusual election even harder to gauge. North Carolina voted for Barack Obama by just 14,000 votes 8 years ago. What happens here this go-round, that's anybody's guess. For The World, Jason Margolis, Raleigh, North Carolina.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. You know, it's not easy when you're busy, but I do try to think about my carbon footprint. I leave the car at home as often as I can and bike. And it's getting easier, at least in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I live. Right across from my house, in fact, I can hop on a shared bicycle, part of the Hubway program here in Boston, or I can open up an app on my phone and reserve a Zipcar. Shared vehicle programs, whether it's four wheels or two, are popping up in cities all over the globe. One of the newest is City Scoot, which provides electric scooters to riders in Paris. Adeline Sia went to check it out.
We all know Paris can be romantic, but it can also be noisy. Vehicles of all kinds clog the narrow, congested streets, which makes scooters and motorbikes one of the best ways to get around. Every day, 120,000 of them crisscross the city. Now a startup is adding some clean, quiet ones to the mix. Electric scooters. Vincent Bustare of City Scoot explains the company's system doesn't use any dedicated stations for its fleet.
All the scooters are geolocated. You rent the scooter, then you ride it, and then you park it anywhere inside the City Scoot zone, which is inside Paris, basically.
Bustare says this system has attracted 10,000 riders since the company got started 3 months ago. New users have to upload their driver's license online to enroll. Then it's pay-as-you-go, about 30 cents per minute of use. Bustare shows me how to book one of those scooters. City Scoot's dedicated app locates an available scooter down the street. Bustare reserves it and receives a PIN code on his phone, which he punches onto the scooter's small keypad to unlock its mechanism.
Now you can see that the handlebar is unplugged, the dashboard turns on, and the saddle is now open.
We can lift the seat there, and we find a helmet.
Exactly. The helmet inside is adjustable.
And there's no need to worry about the battery. When it gets low, a technical team comes to replace it. And gone are the fumes. Obviously, there's no exhaust pipe on an electric scooter. So gone, too, is the thunderous noise of a motorized vehicle. Here's what this machine's wheels sound like in motion. As he rolls the scooter on the street for demo, Bustare says the quietness of the scooter makes it safer to ride.
So the good thing is that we can hear any vehicle around. So for security, it's even better. And you can only hear the wheels hitting the cobblestones.
So this intrepid reporter needed to try it out for herself.
All right.
Off I went around the block, and I guess he wasn't kidding about those cobblestones.
Okay, just the cobblestones.
In spite of that, the scooter seemed to just glide along.
Very smooth. We're almost at the Champs-Élysées here. I'm not sure I'm going to do that yet. Okay, red light.
But I did go down the Champs-Élysées and even tried a bit of speed on the avenue.
All right.
Feeling morally superior to the traditional smelly and noisy scooters zipping around me. And back to the cobblestones. Soon, more Parisians will be able to enjoy those clean wheels, cobblestones and all. This month, CityScoot will double its fleet to 300 scooters and wants to expand it to 1,000 by spring 2017. For the world, Adeline Cyr, Paris.
Like Adele just said, the electric scooter program is a startup program. That means there's not a lot of information about how successful they may or may not be. But there are plenty of studies completed about another transit program, Bike Share. The different systems are fairly similar. Stations of bikes are placed throughout the city. People check them out for short trips. We have the Hubway here in Boston, and now it seems like most every city has them, from Charlotte to Portland. But I wanted to know, do they actually work? That's a question I put to UC Berkeley's transportation expert, Susan Shaheen.
They're working and they're exploding. I think that's the key takeaway, is there's over 1,000 cities across the globe with bike sharing systems. And as of April 2016, according to Russell Medden, who keeps these counts, there were 1.3 million bikes. And about a million of those bikes were located in China. And these systems continue to grow. We're here in the Bay Area, and we just learned about a week ago that our system is going to grow from 700 bikes to 7,000 bikes.
Wow, that's huge. So when you say they're working, what impact do they actually have on the cities where you find these share programs?
Right. So we have studied bike sharing extensively in North America. We've looked at it in Canada, in the United States, and in Mexico. And one of our most recent studies studied all three of those nations. And what we showed was, through these examinations with members of these services, that as a result of using bike sharing, about 50% of the members said that they were driving personal vehicles much less. These systems are also leading to greater physical activity. we've seen in our analysis of them that as you move away from the urban core, they tend to just serve as magnets to get people to and from public transit. And in areas with less dense public transit networks, the same is indicated.
So if you look at New York and Boston's bike sharing programs, you see the logos of Citibank and New Balance. How are these sharing programs for two wheels funded?
Yeah, that's a great question. We've spent a fair amount of time looking at the business models. And what you're referring to is a part of the sponsorship model, where companies come on board and they help to support and sponsor those programs. And in exchange, they're able to brand the bike sharing programs associated with them. What does this do? It brings additional funds to the table, and it keeps it possible to grow those fleets, have individuals paying relatively low membership rates and daily fees.
So bottom line, Susan, these bike sharing programs, good or bad for cities?
All of our research indicates that this is good for cities. It's offering an alternative mode of public transport. It's an active mode of public transport, and it's helping to complement and augment the public transport system, according to our research.
And in your opinion, is this just the beginning? Do you think bike sharing programs will expand in the future?
If the past is an indication, just in the last 5 or 6 years, these programs are going to continue to expand, become more technologically advanced, include more solar docking. They're going to include more access through smartphone apps and mobile payment systems. And they're going to also include electric bikes.
Susan Shaheen with the Institute of Transportation Studies at UC Berkeley. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And that's The World for this Tuesday. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.